While some hardcore gardeners are starting seeds and sharpening their pruning shears, others are writing lesson plans and coming up with creative ways to convince kids to get their hands dirty. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day. We'll start the hour today with a conversation with David Burt, president of Field to Family, based in Iowa City. We'll talk about the organization's Farm to School initiative that includes school gardens and making sure that fresh local produce shows up in the lunchroom. Then later on, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here to answer your questions about the plants in your life. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and some of us are beginning to see just a little bit of green when we look outside. Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron will be here in a few minutes to answer your questions. But first, David Burt is here. He is president of Field to Family, based in Iowa City. Hello, David. Thank you so much for being here today. And first, for people who aren't familiar with Field to Family, tell me what the mission of the organization is.
Okay, yeah, the mission of Field to Family is really a threefold mission: to educate the public. It's all revolving around local food. So we are attempting to educate. Coffee just arrived. Educate the community about the benefits of local food, both on a nutritional level from the freshness factor and on the economic level by just creating that economic community that keeps small towns like this vital. We attempt to communicate, as in create community, and this is based around markets, based around some events we do at schools called farmer fairs. So the idea of bringing people together around food, which tends to be our centralizing thing. And then the last thing is to celebrate this local food, and that's where we put on the Field Family Festival. Some might be familiar with the Culinary Walk. That's now been going on like 13 years, I think, which is that feels pretty good.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I was really intrigued by your Farm to School program, and you've been working hard as an organization to get into the schools in the Iowa City area and work with kids. You have a number of school gardens in the area, right?
Correct. In conjunction with Soil Mates, which is a program with New Pioneer Co-op, I believe there's five schools in the district that do not yet have gardens, and that's one of our main goals this year, is to complete that picture. And the school gardens have been amazing. There's a lot of research out there that kids learn, they retain, they're more attentive when they're outdoor, when there's a more tactile way of learning. So when they're one of the things we're trying to do is build curriculum so all subjects can be adapted to be taught in the garden.
So you're not just talking about teaching kids about food and gardening, I'm sure that's a big part of it, but actually coming up with ways to teach their other subjects.
Absolutely.
In the garden.
And this is one of the keys. I mean, there's the content, we call it the content factor, which is teaching about gardens, but the form of the garden itself is an amazing, we call it the outdoor classroom. And it's as simple as taking a bunch of carrots and dividing them in two, and there's your math lesson. But that tactile nature of touching the carrot, of being in touch with these solid objects, has been shown to be beneficial for the kids.
There is a really frustrating problem with school gardens in the state of Iowa, and that is that so much of our growing season, of course, coincides with summer vacation. So with the school gardens that you've been working with, how do you get kids involved so early in the growing season out there and get them to see some sort of payoff?
Well, I suppose that's going on at this stage. In all honesty, it's as much getting parents and teachers involved at the volunteer level, and that enthusiasm is what spreads to the kids. You know, as you probably know, they've been planning their planting now for a month or two. So getting kids involved in that early stages is another way to see the big picture, and that's another part of what the goal of Farm to School is, to see the essential nature of our local food system and, in a way, taking it back under our own control. So showing them the planning, the importance of saving seeds, which they learn at the end of the season. Well, they learn then that, on a tactile way at the beginning of the season when the seed's planted. So while it is true, there's that kind of July, August period where things go to, it's actually one of our goals to have someone maintain them over the summer. We're about 2-3 years into this, the school gardens program, and you know, that's coming along. So I think there's a learning in every aspect. And so when they come back after a month and a half and they see what happens to a garden that has not been tended, huge lessons in that.
Now, are you able to recruit some of the families and maybe even some of those students?
Absolutely.
For a lot of these different gardens?
Yeah, and as I say, currently it's the enthusiasm and vibrancy of parents and volunteer teachers at the moment who are really driving this. And one of our goals this year is to create from that a mentorship program down through the university. There's a university garden club, and we're in the process of trying to bring in interns who are going to help mentor the high school students, who then help mentor the junior high school students. So the farmer fairs take place usually at elementary schools. So those kids who've seen that in their early days, as they go up through the school, the idea is that they then get introduced to the deeper layers, and as they begin to mentor the students in that way.
Now, I realize that this program is not that old yet. What kind of payoff have some of the educators been able to see from this garden interaction with students and this contact with farmers?
Well, I think, again, going back to that, just the engagement, the ease with which they can engage the students has been inspiring for the teachers and parents. And I think in the long-term payoff, let me backtrack. There was a teacher at Southeast who talked about water quality. 15, 20 years ago, volunteer teachers talked about water quality. Lo and behold, here 15 years later, it's on the curriculum. So that's really what we hope to build into the program. And so that enthusiasm is going to build year to year, because these kids are going to see the gardens through their whole school career.
So this is, in your mind, the beginning of a revolution.
I believe so, yes.
You've also been involved with Field to Family with getting fresh produce into school lunches as well in the Iowa City School District. That seems like a big challenge, considering how challenging making school lunches are and the budgets for school lunches and the preparation and all of that. But how successful have you been with that?
I'd say very successful. You know, my background is in the restaurant industry, so I'm familiar with the troubles of institutional buying of local food, which is knowing when it's going to be available, a big one. But the most difficult aspect of this is the financial aspect. And there just isn't enough, unless the farmers begin to kind of subsidize and donate their produce. That's one of the real big...
Which is challenging for a lot of
farmers,
right?
Which then the farmers are already, you know, losing money on every carrot they grow. That's the old joke, isn't it? So I think long term, well, let me tell you at least what we did last year.
Okay.
And this feels good to be able to look back, because all these things took immense amounts of work. But in January, on one day, every school in the district served sweet potatoes from, I believe it was Kelowna. Sweet potatoes on them, things like sweet potatoes present interesting challenges on the preparation. You mentioned the preparation. Most of the food that comes into schools is frozen and it's already prepped. So these are there's no money to pay the labor to prep the food. So again, one of our long-term goals is to really find, whether it's a subsidizing or it's money from some layer of government that comes in specifically for local food in schools. Let me just go through again what we did last year. So January, of all months, sweet potatoes. In July, we had cucumbers, cabbage, zucchini. August, we had zucchini and cantaloupe. September, we had zucchini, watermelon, tomatoes, cucumbers, red peppers, apples. And in October, tomatoes, cucumber, potatoes, and apples. Now, all those being served in every school in the district. And the old joke about zucchinis here is this: every month from July to September, that's the one thing we might be able to predict that we'll have enough of for
right.
the schools. And of course, it's the one that they probably like. You know, zucchini bread's about all we can foist on the kids at this stage. We're working on that in nutritional education.
It's an evolution,
too.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, there are so many different programs that have been working towards similar goals. I mean, there are Iowa State University Extension has a program, Pick a Better Snack, that they have been bringing into schools all over the state of Iowa. So it seems like there are now a lot of groups working toward similar ends with getting kids familiar, not just with gardening, but with this kind of food as well. Now, of course, I realize that you have a lot of background in the restaurant business and you've prepared a lot of food. You've fed a lot of children as well, including your own. Do you see progress being made as far as that goes, getting kids exposed to fresh fruits and vegetables and more willing to eat them?
Absolutely. I think, again, the context of this particular conversation is the fact that as long as we start in kindergarten, well, it's a 10-year plan, but if we educate kindergartners now and every kindergarten level student for the next 10 years, that by the time they leave school, they're going to know what a squash is. They're going to understand that, I mean, this, not to get too technical, but the pigments in food are actually highly beneficial. And I was very surprised. I mean, my interaction with farm to school did begin with the preparation of the vegetable samples at the farmer fair. So it's always surprising how kids react differently. I mean, there are some kids who are literally pulling the spinach spread that I made off other people's plates. There are kids who won't even touch it. And I think just that exposure is going to be the long-term educational benefit. Like, the kids don't need to like the food, but to know what a squash is, or that there are orange foods and blue foods and black foods. These are just basic skills that they can have, if you get my drift.
Yeah, important steps along the way. And you are planning more farmer fairs this year?
Absolutely. Yeah, we've, you know, it's unconfirmed, but we're hoping to get one in at Penn, which is, I think, the biggest school in the, or one of the bigger ones in the district. So we're going to do one in the spring, one in the fall. We have to split it in two for that one. And, you know, that's where we do an all-day workshop. We teach about soil quality, the importance of saving seeds. We usually do a sampling of whatever's in season. This is another huge lesson, just understanding that there's a season to vegetables, which many kids just don't know.
Right. Well, we've created a society where we're removed from that because you can have anything at any time.
Correct. And you know, of all the places, Iowa would be might be the place to start.
Absolutely.
With our seasonality here, it's amazing.
And you also have an event coming up this evening.
We
you
do indeed.
A,
we have
a benefit and a silent art auction this evening.
Correct. Down at the Wedge from 6 to 8. We've had the great fortune to have an original Salvador Dali print to be up for this auction. It's kind of the star of the show. And we've gathered, a dozen and a half pieces from local artists. So, we're going to have food samples, a raffle. We've had great sponsorship from New Pioneer Co-op, Share Wine Lounge, and a few others.
All right. So that's tonight from 6 to 8 at the Wedge downtown
Iowa
City.
Correct.
All right. David Burt, thank you so much.
Thanks, Charity.
David Burt is president of Field to Family based in Iowa City. Coming up in just a moment, we will be answering your questions about the plants in your life. Richard Giron will be here. Give us a call with your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100, or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It is Horticulture Day today, and of course, we are here to answer your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org, or you can post on our Facebook page. Richard Giron of Iowa State University Extension is here now. Hello, Richard.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today. And we talked about starting seeds a couple of weeks ago. If you're starting vegetables, it's pretty much time now, isn't it?
Maybe this weekend, things like peppers, eggplant, as far as tomatoes, maybe in another 10 days or so.
Okay, so we still have to hold on a little bit for the tomatoes.
Yes.
But it is time to get some things growing.
Absolutely, yes.
All right, and of course, we are starting to see a little bit, a tiny bit of green in the landscape as well. We've talked a lot about pruning, so that's something that people really need to get on if they're planning.
Right. There's no rush. It doesn't have to be done today or tomorrow, but basically sometime probably in the next two or three weeks, and that would be things like trees and shrubs and fruit trees and raspberries, grapevine. So sometime in the next 2 or 3 weeks.
All right. And my lilac bush was talking to me this morning about needing to be pruned as well. That's something I can still do, right?
Absolutely, yes.
All right. I've gotten lots of advice from you on that front over the years. If you'd like to join our conversation with your questions about any of the plants in your life, give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Mike is on the line first from Riverside. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I planted some garlic this fall, but I didn't get a chance to cover it with leaves or straw. I don't know if I'm going to run the risk of having winter kill or not.
That's a possibility, but only time will tell. I think most areas had pretty good snow cover, and snow acts like a blanket, so that's a plus if you've had good snow cover. So hopefully you'll start to see some growth in April.
Okay. Can I still help it out if I add leaves or straw at this time?
I don't think so at this time, no.
No? Okay. No. How about fertilizer during the summer?
You could apply possibly a all-purpose garden fertilizer in a band, maybe down one side of the row, maybe sometime in maybe late April, early May. And I would just use like a 10-10-10. An all-purpose
right.
garden fertilizer, and just do that.
Okay. All right. Okay. Hey, thanks.
Yeah, good luck, Mike. Thanks
a lot
for your call.
All right, thank you. Yeah, bye.
Bye. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. We still have a few lines open for your call, 866-780-9100. Jan is on the line in Iowa City. Hi, Jan.
Hi, good morning, everybody. Welcome back for spring. That's great. My question is, someone told me yesterday that the depth of freeze this year is about 6 feet, whereas the average freeze is usually about 18 inches in the ground. And I was wondering how this affects seedling start dates and planting out dates. Will things be delayed, or what are the seeds going according to?
Well, I think as far as the seeds are concerned, it's the weather over the next, let's say, 3 to 4 weeks, because we're going to plant the seeds fairly shallow. So the soil should thaw out fairly quickly, and the soil near the surface warm up fairly quickly. So really the key is actually the temperatures over the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Okay, so you would advise following the standard guidelines for when to start seedlings, because the soil surface will warm up even if the underlying is much slower.
Right, right.
Okay.
And I would say at this time this year, looking at the forecast for the next several days, I'm going to guess we're going to be at least 1 or 2 weeks behind schedule this year at this point.
For planting out?
Right, just because it's been so cold so long, and early next week it's going to be in the 30s for highs, 20s at night. So it's going to be, I think, a slow warm-up. So I'm guessing maybe a week or two behind schedule if the weather pans out.
So if I don't want my seedlings to get real big before I plant them out, I might delay a week or two.
Right, if you start them inside, right.
Right. I'm thinking of starting tomatoes at the end of this month.
Okay.
Is that right?
I would be shooting probably for the first week or so in April, actually.
Okay.
Because they grow so quickly, and you typically don't want a tall, lanky tomato plant. You'd like to have a fairly short, stocky plant.
Okay. Even if you're going to plant the stem far below the surface?
You can do that when they're tall and lanky, but I prefer a short, stocky plant. I think they get off to a faster start than a tall, lanky thing, because winds can be awfully brutal in the spring, and those tall, lanky plants can get kind of beaten up by the wind. So,
all right, Jan, thank you so much for your call. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can also send questions to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Do you think that we're going to see our spring bulbs also be a week or two behind schedule, Richard?
Yeah, I would say so, absolutely. Normally, I start to see a few things in late February around my house. I didn't see anything until about mid-March, so we had so much snow, so cold temperatures that Things were simply not coming up at all. So,
right. That may.
Which is okay. Which is okay.
Right.
We're just going to be a little bit late.
It's okay unless you plan a tulip festival. That's always tricky.
They'll be okay this year, I think.
All right. Mary is on the line next from Ames. Hi, Mary.
Hello.
Hi.
I wondered on orchids how to get them to bloom. It got one new leaf last summer and is getting a new leaf now that's just beginning.
Well, just give them good, consistent care. There are a lot of different orchids, but in general, if you give them bright light, they don't need direct sun, but they should be near a window where they get bright light, and water them properly. Fertilize
once
them.
Once a week, is that sufficient?
Usually it is, but check to make sure.
Okay.
And fertilize periodically in the spring and summer. And so just give them good, consistent care. If they have the proper environment, the proper care, they'll go ahead and bloom.
At what strength do you fertilize?
Excuse me?
At what strength do you fertilize? A weak fertilizer or?
Oh, I would probably use a dilute fertilizer solution that you can make from a water-soluble product.
Mm-hmm.
Make it easy.
And how often you fertilize?
It depends upon the strength, but I would say probably every 2 weeks or so would be good.
All right, Mary, good luck with that. Thank you so much for your call. And next up, let's go to Chris on the line in Robbins. Hi, Chris.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is, I have a backyard and I'm trying to plant as many natural plants or indigenous plants to Iowa in it and still have it be a yard, you know, be pretty. I have cornflowers and black-eyed Susans or black Susans and trees and maple bushes and maple trees. I'm trying to make it bird-friendly, but I was wondering what you would suggest, and can I start just going to all native plants?
Well, it's up to you. You obviously can, but I think there's some nice ornamentals that are maybe not native to Iowa, too. For example, I would probably include some evergreens. Not very many evergreens are native to Iowa, but they're nice to have in the landscape for birds as far as shelter and things like that.
Right. I have the evergreen trees.
So it's nice if you want to emphasize the native ones. We have some really nice native plants, both trees, shrubs, perennials, et cetera. But also maybe include a few of the exotic plants like the evergreens for their benefits, too.
Well, and... You've talked a lot about aronia berries or chokecherries on the show recently. That's something, of course, birds love in the landscape and is native to
aronia
Iowa and grows well.
Aronia berries?
Well, you can plant a number of things that will attract birds and things like that. For example, the dogwoods, a very common shrub. They do produce a fruit, a small berry-like fruit that the birds will definitely eat. Many of the viburnums also produce the fruit that the birds like to eat. So a number of shrubs will produce things. They'll provide shelter, but they also provide food. It's always nice to have some crabapples, I think, in the landscape for the birds, in that many of the newer varieties have these small, very persistent fruit. And in the fall and winter, especially early winter, the fruit are very, very hard, and the birds simply will not eat them. But by late winter, early spring, when you have flocks of robins coming back and things like that, by that time of year, the freezing and thawing has kind of softened the fruit, and the hungry birds find those berries to be very, very attractive at that point.
All right. Well, good luck with your plantings, Chris. Thanks a lot for your call. Next up, let's go to Kevin in Belleville. Hey, Kevin.
Hey, good morning to you both. Thanks for taking my call. A question regarding topsoil. I know typically I need to improve the compost topsoil mixture. I'm just wondering if he knows about where to get that in a sustainable way if you're a vegetable gardener, and sources that he would consider looking for, you know, rather than being trucked in from Missouri or other places. I just don't want to do that. So just kind of wondering how to troubleshoot some good topsoil.
Well, finding topsoil can be very difficult. As far as maybe compost, many cities especially larger cities, have a composting facility where people bring their yard waste, like their grass clippings, their leaves, their small branches, and that's composted. And then usually the facility will go ahead and then sell some of that compost to their area residents. So
I've had issues with that, and only in regards to it comes from many sources. Many times it can even come from golf courses, other places where people spray a lot. It's all of a sudden my garden is I'm really putting some chemicals back into my own garden that I'm trying to avoid if it's a municipal situation like that, unless you know otherwise. That through decomposition, maybe some of it goes away. But I guess some of the levels were a little higher than I wanted on my own garden, so I didn't go to that city source.
Well, typically, if you go to a city source, they do have grass clippings from residents that may be using herbicides. So there may be some pesticides in the material.
Right.
But if it's composted correctly, you're going to have extremely high temperatures, and usually the small amounts of pesticides in there will break down. So I don't see that as being a problem typically as far as using it.
Even herbicides, though?
Even herbicides, yes.
Okay. I took a soil from that and had it tested. It was fairly high, and since we were trying to grow organically for my family, I backed off for the last 3 years after having that tested. And maybe it didn't get hot enough. Maybe it was taken from an outside area source and it never, cooked long enough. I'm not sure.
Well, it all depends upon the composting facility, if it's done properly, if they have a mix of various materials, if it's turned often, where you get the very high temperatures and where things do break down. It's not organic because there will be very, very small traces of pesticide in it, but extremely small.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for your call.
Sure.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Geron. Next up is Jim on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'm trying to judge the dates for the farmers market items that normally we'll see corn and tomatoes in the middle to later part of August up here, July. And I was just wondering if we should be, expecting that to get moved back a ways.
I would think at this point, you never can predict long-term in Iowa as far as the weather. But at this point, I'm going to predict it's going to be a little bit later than normal.
Yep.
So it might be, for example, before you see a lot of sweet corn, it may be a little bit later than normal. The same with tomatoes. That's kind of my guess.
Well, let's hope for the best.
But you never know about Iowa weather, so.
No, and who knows? We could have no tomatoes and corn if we get really unlucky, right?
Well, hopefully not.
Yeah, well, hopefully
we'll
not,
have something. Yeah. We'll have something.
Yeah.
Well. All right, Jim. Thanks a lot for your call.
Sure.
We do all want you to be a soothsayer, don't we, Richard?
Well, I'm a native Iowan, so the weather can change within a few minutes. So
it's true.
Who knows?
It's suddenly Wednesday, it could be 80. We'll see.
It could be. Probably
right.
Not. Probably not, but
probably
it could be.
Probably not. All right, Rick is on the line next in Iowa City. Hi, Rick.
Morning.
Hi. What's your question?
My question is the way our backyard is landscaped with the recent melt-off and all the rains and stuff, a lot of times we have water collecting down in one corner that causes a lot of soggy mud, and we have a dog. And we were going to put down a bunch of straw this spring, and I was wondering, since I'm putting straw down, would it be too early to also put some grass seed under that straw at this point and then get a head start perhaps or have it ready to go when the weather warms up, the conditions are better for it. Basically, my question is it too early to put grass seed down if you're going to have straw over it?
Yeah. I would be inclined to wait just because it's just not going to germinate for quite some time yet. And I guess my concern would be that things can happen to it where maybe the birds might eat some seed. We could have a hard rain which washes away some of the seed. And so I would be inclined to probably wait and maybe do it maybe around mid-April, because by then the temperatures will be warmer as far as soil temperatures. And hopefully, if you can get it down at that point, if you have favorable soil temperatures and you get it down and you have good seed-soil contact and you have moisture, it should germinate almost immediately at that point. So I'd be inclined to wait.
Okay. Thank you much.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call. And let's see if we can fit in an email question here before we get to the break. This is from Joshua. Last fall, I brought my giant potted rosemary bush indoors. It stayed alive during the winter but got very lanky. Should I trim it way back before I take it back outside?
I probably wouldn't. The first thing I'd probably do is maybe bring it outside toward the end of April. And I would put it initially in the shade and then gradually expose the plant to longer periods of sunlight. And after about a week or 10 days, it can go in full sun. And then once it's been outside for maybe a few weeks, then maybe prune it back.
All right. We are going to take a short break. We'll be back to answer more of your questions in just a moment. It is Horticulture Day today on Talk of Iowa. And with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. You can call with your questions at 866-780-9100, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's Horticulture Day today, and with me, Iowa State University Extension horticulturist Richard Giron. And, of course, he's here to answer your questions. Give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Michelle is up next in Fayette. Hello, Michelle.
Hello.
Hi. What's your question?
Well, we have a tulip poplar, and the diameter, I would say, of the trunk is at least a foot, and it's flowered, so it's probably 20, 30 feet tall. And this winter, not all the way from the base, but there's a vertical seam, like a crack.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we had trimmed a limb as well, from that scar tissue, another vertical incision, whatever it had started. And I was just wondering, you know, is there any hope? Will it, you know, it opened up, you know, maybe an eighth to a quarter inch, but then when it warms up, it seems to close up.
Mm-hmm. Well,
yeah.
some trees will do that. Some trees will do that. For example, some of the oaks will do that. And we're not sure of the exact cause, but we think it's due to extreme cold. Because when you have extreme cold, things tend to contract, and sometimes they will crack. And so it occurs on certain trees, typically in the wintertime. The crack itself is not going to kill the tree. That's not a concern. The concern is if you have a small crack, then moisture can get in that crack, and then eventually you may get rotting starting to occur. And so that's really the chief concern. That's the chief threat, in that if this crack gets some moisture in it, you start to get some rotting, and then as if that rot gets extensive, then the trunk of the tree may become structurally unsound. Okay? But this is a long-term thing as far as this happening. It happens over many years, but that could eventually happen, where you get some major decay in the tree, the trunk becomes structurally unsound, and then you have a strong storm with strong winds, and maybe it possibly gets broken off or breaks off. So, but that's not going to happen anytime soon, but eventually it could happen. Now, as far as what you can do, you really can't do anything. Painting it, for example, trying to paint that or fill that crack in doesn't really do any good. So that doesn't help. So you just kind of wait and hope for the best. Trees do have the ability to kind of seal off these areas. Sometimes they do a good job, sometimes they don't, but they have that ability. But there's not much that we can do to assist a tree with that wound-type response.
Yes. So just monitoring the tree would be the ideal. And
right.
What would be signs of decay or rot, early signs perhaps?
You would just see some decay at that wound, at that crack, where it becomes soft and kind of spongy.
All right.
When you see that, you know you have some decay there.
Michelle, thank you so much for your call. Steve is on the line next in Des Moines. Hi, Steve.
Yes. I have some substantial bare spots in my lawn. I tried planting seeds last fall. I'm just checking them out this morning. I don't think the seeds have taken. My question is, I always put this four-step pre-emergent fertilizer on my lawn.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any chance if I didn't put that on this year that, you know, I'd be happy with crabgrass in those spots? Would it fill in with crabgrass if I hold on?
Probably. It probably would.
Creeping Charlie might grow well there
well,
as well.
Creeping Charlie would be fine. I, you know, if it's green from the street, I'm happy. But the big bare spots kind of...
Yeah.
You are a lawn maintenance guy after my own heart, Steve. That sounds great.
So
well, just one more quick... Okay, go ahead.
So what I'd probably do is my inclination would be to go ahead and maybe put on a fertilizer pre-emergent herbicide this spring. And since you're calling from Des Moines, probably sometime in the latter half of April. And basically, the pre-emergent would prevent the crabgrass from coming up, so you're not going to have that. But hopefully, the fertilizer would encourage the grass to grow and spread.
Okay, I see.
That's the theory on that. Now, if this doesn't work out very well, if you still have some bare spots, then I would try to reseed those bare spots around late August.
Wow.
About the last week in August. And the first thing you need to do is go out there and at least rake it lightly because you need good seed-soil contact. So rake it lightly, break the soil surface, sow your grass seed, rake it lightly into the soil, and then keep it moist, the seed bed, and hopefully within 2 weeks you'll have some grass, and then you'll have ideal growing conditions the rest of September and October. And by the end of October, you should have a nice stand of grass.
All right. And Steve, did
put
you say you had...
Put the pre-emergent on.
Oh, I'm sorry. What was that question?
I should go ahead and put the pre-emergent on then last of April and prevent the crabgrass and
right.
then seed it in the fall.
Right. And try to get the grass to spread as best you can. And if it doesn't, like you want it to, then I would reseed in late August.
Okay. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Steve. And you can join our conversation. We still have time for a few more questions this hour. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Next up is Don in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Don.
Good morning. I had a question. It relates to a perennial bed that had fungus. The bed's is next to a deck. And there's other fences around it, so there might have been some issue of air flowing freely, but it does face the southeast. And the plant that was seemed to be impacted the worst was a phlox.
Mm, yeah.
But anyway, I used a fungicide on it numerous times, but I never and it sometimes kept it down, but never really was able to beat it. So anyway,
yeah.
We're going to rip it out and start over. And the question is, what should I do to make certain that the fungus is taken care of?
Oh, I don't think you really have to do much of anything. If you're referring to garden phlox is very prone to powdery mildew. That's one of its major drawbacks.
Okay.
And if you have poor air circulation, the conditions become more favorable for the powdery mildew.
Okay.
So what you might consider doing, if these are garden phlox plants, you might consider somebody digging them up and transplanting them and putting them in a site where they get much better air circulation and full sun. And the powdery mildew may be much more much less severe in that new location.
Okay. But what about cleaning up the area before we plant other new things?
A lot of plants will not be susceptible to that powdery mildew. So most of your plant pathogens tend to be very plant-specific. Something that would affect a garden phlox would typically not affect a peony or vice versa.
Okay, but I mean, it was worse than the phlox, but it was on adjacent plants also.
Okay. Well, Make sure that they have the right growing conditions. If they prefer full sun, make sure they have full sun.
Yeah.
Make sure you don't crowd the plants, because if you crowd the plants real close together, that cuts down on air circulation too.
There was some of that too, yes.
Okay, so just try to clean up the dead debris and choose plants that are well-suited for the site and make sure they're not too crowded.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for your call, Don. And let's get to a couple of email questions here before we get back to the phones. Here is one from Joel. How deep should a raised bed, not on the ground, be for the root system of veggies to flourish?
It can be as low as maybe 4 to 6 inches, because when you make that raised bed, you're also going to work up the soil beneath it too, and hopefully improve that also.
Okay, when he says a raised bed, not on the ground, I'm not sure if he's would work out for
okay.
him.
Okay, he could do that, where basically there's nothing underneath it.
Mm-hmm.
If you did that, I would say probably at least 8 inches of good soil.
Okay. All right. And this is from Bruce. I looked for all-purpose garden fertilizer 10-10-10 last year, but never found any. Is that still around?
It still is.
All right.
you'll find it in some of the bigger home and farm stores, garden centers, discount stores, hardware stores. It's there.
Why would it be harder to find?
I'm not sure. They tend to have all these specialty fertilizers, and they sometimes don't stock some of the common things.
All right. You can give us a call with your question at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Elena is on the line in Coralville. Hello, Elena.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your question?
My question is about the ash trees. Is it reasonable to treat them, and will it work? And how do you do that?
Well, our recommendation is not to treat them unless the insect has been found within 15 miles of your location.
And Coralville is not one of those sites.
Right.
Within how many?
Within 15 miles.
15 miles?
Right. So if they haven't been found within 15 miles, we typically would recommend you don't treat. And that's because you don't want to use a pesticide if you don't have to. And also it can be fairly expensive. Now, if they're found in your area, in your county, and you have this really large, very healthy ash tree, then the question is, do I want to treat? You definitely can, but the treatment typically will last 1 year, possibly two at most. So you do have to do it fairly often. And so you have to consider, do I want to do that? Can I afford to do that? But you definitely can do that. The insecticides are effective. I think what I would be doing is, if I had the space, I would be planting other trees in my yard so that when this insect does arrive, I have other choices, alternatives. And so I would look at maybe a maple tree, maybe an oak tree, a linden tree, hackberry, honey locust, something else, so that when a time comes, I'll have other trees in my yard.
And there are a lot of environmental concerns about these pesticides that are being used for emerald ash borer. We're starting to see a lot more conversation about that. So it's a money commitment for a long-term treatment, plus you could be putting something dangerous into the environment, right, Richard?
You're using a pesticide, yes. It's a pesticide. So
isn't it really expensive to have the tree cut down, though?
Oh, it can be expensive to do that, too. Absolutely, yes. So you have to consider your choices and the cost of doing it. Absolutely, yes. Taking a tree down is expensive also, yeah.
It's not a pretty situation. Sorry, Elena.
No, but I would try to enjoy the tree as long as you can. If it's a nice, healthy specimen, I would enjoy it as long as you can. And when the time comes when it is found in the Iowa City area, then you have to consider your options.
All right, Elena, thank you so much for your call. I'm sure we'll be talking a lot more about the emerald ash borer as this growing season goes on and for years to come. Dennis is on the line next in Marshalltown. I want to mention again, we do have a couple lines open right now. We could squeeze in a few more calls before the end of the hour. 866-780-9100 is the number. Hi, Dennis. Dennis, are you
Hello?
There? Hi, what's
yeah.
your question?
Yeah, my lawn care person didn't put down broadleaf control last fall, and wondered what I could do about that this spring. And I have another question is I'm trying to fill in my ditches with crown vetch, but if I burn the ditches off, will that kill the crown vetch?
As far as burning the ditch, will that kill the crown vetch? No. crown vetch is a very tough, resilient plant. That's not going to kill it. As far as putting on a broadleaf herbicide, I would wait until the dandelions are growing, about ready to bloom, and then put on your broadleaf herbicide.
All right, Dennis, thanks a lot for your call. Eldon is up next in Atkins with a suggestion for us. Hi, Eldon.
Well, good morning. I heard a lady having a hard time finding a balanced fertilizer, 10-10-10 or 13-13-13. If she would check with her local farm co-op, they almost always carry that type of fertilizer. It may be in a larger size than she's used to, 40 or 50 pounds, but sometimes they will split a bag or, get that from their bulk fertilizer to get that balanced P and K and nitrogen.
All right, Eldon, thanks a lot for sharing that. Let's get to the we've got a lot of people who have suggestions. Dave is on the line next in Crawfordsville. Hi, Dave.
Hello there.
Hi, what's your suggestion?
I'm calling just to maybe help out a little bit with the gentleman that wanted to plant some grass seed, and you're telling him to, if he really wants the grass seed, wait till October. Well, my finding has been this, is that we can plant it now, and or plant not now, but a little earlier or later on in the spring here, and put some ryegrass on top of it, and then keep sowing a little bit more even during the summertime and keep it wet. And I'll bet you you'll have a grass going there by 4th of July that you'll have to mow quite often.
Well, you can sow grass in the spring. Typically, though, results are better if we do it in late summer. When we do it in the spring, we tend to get a lot of weed competition. If we do it in late summer, typically we have very few weeds coming up at that point. So you can do it in the spring, but usually the best results occur in late summer. So,
All right, Dave, thanks a lot for your call. And last question of the day, this is from Andrea and Marion. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I know you just have a few moments. So there is a lot of salt in my yard from the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I am wondering, I was thinking last fall that I'd like to plant that into perennials because it gets full sun. However, because of the amount of salt, I wonder what kind of plants I could think about growing there.
Boy, I don't know of any salt resistant plants offhand, but I think one way to cope with that is try to maybe go out in the spring once the ground does thaw out and thoroughly water the area, in effect leaching the salt away from the roots of the plants. And so you can do that where you have a bad year, for example, and you have a lot of snow and therefore a lot of salt. You can actually go out there once that ground thaws out and really flush it and get rid of most of the salt from the plants.
All right, Andrea, thank you so much for your call. And Richard Geron, thank you.
You're welcome.
And maybe we'll get through this next cold snap and
maybe
have some warmer weather next Friday when we talk. Thanks a lot. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, Sarah Bowden, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. We had technical assistance today from Cooper Holmeyer. And you can let us know what you'd like to hear on Talk of Iowa. We love to get your feedback. You can respond to things you've heard on the show or make suggestions by sending email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Coming up on Monday, Home Improvement Day with Bill McAnally. We'll talk deconstruction.